calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, when Jimmy Carter said it,
there's no doubt in my mind that Al Gore was elected president. He received the most votes nationwide, and in my opinion, he also received the most votes in Florida. And the decision was made, as you know, by a 5-4 vote on a highly partisan basis by the U.S. Supreme Court. So I would say in 2000, there was a failure.
Yeah, a highly partisan vote on the Supreme Court. Al Gore was made president in large part because of the efforts of one man. One man, one guy who flew down to Florida and personally advised Jeb Bush on how to avoid a possible Democratic strategy of suing to prevent certification of the voters of the Electoral College vote, and then coached the lawyers who were going to argue before the United States Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore about how to successfully argue before Chief Justice Rehnquist, who could be the deciding vote, of course. It was a 5-4 decision. That man, John Roberts, just confirmed Chief Justice of the United States. Earlier today, I spoke with Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon on my on the local program that I do for AM620 KPOJ here in Portland. And that senator, as many have, although he was, you know, kind enough to actually come on the air and talk about it, you know, a lot of them who support Roberts are not willing to, but it, you know, came out and essentially said, well, rather than quoting Ron Wyden, because I actually don't have his quotes right in front of me, so rather than putting these words in his mouth, let me just say broadly, because, you know, Carl Levin came out with a statement yesterday. It's on his website now. Carl Levin, actually from Michigan, one of the more articulate pro-Roberts Democrats, goes through a list of the positions that Roberts has taken over the years that are right-wing ideological crank positions, and then says, but when I met him in private, he said something different. When I met him in private, he said something different. When he testified before us in public, he said something different. I don't think he's going to do this anymore. And essentially, this was the same thing that Ron Wyden said this morning, that he had met with him in private, you know, blah, blah, blah. He seems like a very temperate guy, very thoughtful, you know, he's not a bug-eyed fanatic. Neither was Rudolf Hess. I'm just, you know, very, very concerned. In Sinclair Lewis's novel, It Can't Happen Here, back in the 1930s, he wrote this novel about the rise to power of a United States senator fueled by a right-wing talk show host who essentially put America, threw America into a total fascistic state by using the campaign slogan of family values. Yes, family values, that phrase came from It Can't Happen Here by Sinclair Lewis back in the 1930s. The story of, what was it, Buzz Winthrop? As I recall, anyhow, the story of this newspaper publisher in New England. My recollection was it was New Hampshire. It might have been Vermont. This newspaper publisher in New England who was courageously fighting against the rise of this right-wing senator who became president and led America down the path to fascism. And then the newspaper editor had to go to Canada, fled to Canada, then came back and kind of fought the resistance, and I'll leave it at that. You can read the book yourself. It's a marvelous read. A little slow, written in the style of the 1930s, but still it's a marvelous book, still in print. And the point that he made, the point that Sinclair Lewis made in that book, that has been that is the point that you will find in I believe it's Milton Mayer, or maybe it's Martin Mayer. I always get it wrong. I think it's Milton Mayer's book, They Thought They Were Free, about the Germans in the 1930s who did nothing as Hitler was rising to power. The point that Sinclair Lewis made and the point that Mayer made is, gee, they didn't look like bug-eyed fanatics to me. They seemed like very reasonable people. Speaking of bug-eyed fanatics, and the bugs that go with them. The king of the bug killers has been indicted. Ronnie Earle, the prosecutor for the county in which Austin, Texas is located, who, as such, prosecutes cases statewide. Ronnie Earle has issued an indictment. Actually, not even him. It was a grand jury that he had impaneled. So the jurors in this grand jury, looking at the evidence, have said, Tom DeLay, looks like there's enough of a probability that this guy's a crook that we're going to issue an indictment against him. Tom DeLay, of course, doing what, in a high-profile case, is conventional wisdom that should be done by a criminal defendant, and that is try to influence potential jurors. That's the first imperative. Try to influence potential jurors. Get out there ahead of the curve. Get out your talking points. Make it so that, you know, to the extent that you can, make it so that people think that it's not you who have done something. It is the prosecutor who has done something. The prosecutor's the bad guy. The prosecutor's the evil one. And he's influence those jurors so that when they are impaneled, so there's this little window of time when you can influence the jurors before you have any legal restrictions on doing that. And if you can influence them so that when they finally are selected, because you don't know who they are, so you just try to influence everybody, right? So that when they're selected, they go into that courtroom already assuming, that prosecutor, he's a lying, you know, whatever. Or he's a partisan, whatever. So, of course, Tom DeLay.
Too predictable result of a vengeful investigation led by a partisan fanatic.
Partisan fanatic.
Mr. Earle is abusing the power of his office to exact personal revenge for the role I played in the Texas Republican legislative campaign in 2002 and my advocacy for a new, fair, and constitutional congressional map for our state in 2003.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, Mr. Bug Eye Bug Killer, Tom DeLay, unfortunately, none of those issues are on the table. But see, that's what he's trying. He's trying to put that in the minds of the jurors. Here's Ronnie Earle responding to the charge that he is a partisan hack, that he only goes after Republicans, and that's why Tom DeLay's in his crosshairs.
The law says that the duty of the prosecuting attorney is not to convict, but to see that justice is done. We have, over the years, prosecuted a number of elected officials. At last count, that total stood at 15, 12 of whom were Democrats and 3 of whom were Republicans.
Uh-oh.
Our job is to prosecute abuses of power. And our job is to bring those abuses to the attention of the public through juries, and that's what we do when we find a violation of the law.
So he's prosecuted 3 times more Democrats than Republicans. Oh, he must be a partisan hack. Maybe? Say what? Huh? So anyhow, here you've got Tom DeLay trying to say, oh, no. It's all about Ronnie Earle. It's all about the, you know, he's trying to get me. It's, you know, he's out. But in reality,
now the DeLay Political Death Watch
is underway. It is just plain old, flat out, simply underway. There's no other way to say it. Tom DeLay is going down. He's going down. And why? Well, it's got nothing to do with Ronnie Earle being a partisan hack. I mean, you look at some of the things that he's done. Tom DeLay's been a very busy guy. In 1998. This is from the Center for American Progress. 13 highlights from DeLay's illustrious career. In 1988, he helped kill a congressional fact-finding trip that was being planned as part of an investigation of sweatshop conditions in the garment industry in the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. Why? Well, because Jack Abramoff, his good friend, who's under indictment himself, and, one of the guys involved with these guys just was murdered, and it's getting very, very dirty. Jack Abramoff was opposed to this trip. And so then they kind of flipped it around. Abramoff then takes DeLay out there, and DeLay says, isn't this wonderful? This place a paradise for these workers. Here's another one. DeLay raises corporate cash for Trimpac. He's embroiled in a scandal in Texas. This is, of course, what is bringing him down. He bribes a congressman to vote for Medicare. He had admitted offering to endorse Senator Nick Smith's son, Brad, Republican from Michigan, was Republican from Michigan, who was running for Congress at the time in exchange for Smith's yes vote on the Medicare bill. The House Ethics Panel has rebuked DeLay for using government resources to help locate a private plane he thought was carrying Texas Democratic legislators. He tried to force the legislators back to the Capitol so he could push through his, quote, bitterly disputed congressional redistricting. Yeah. So Tom DeLay going down. Interesting, though, who's going to follow? 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom DeLay last night on Fox News, on Sean Hannity's program. He says, Ronnie Earl has established no intent, no motive to commit a crime. Right? In other words, you got to have motive, means, and opportunity to have a crime. And Ronnie Earl has been looking into the activities of TRIMPAC. There have been 6 grand juries now over the last few years. And as a result, over 40 people have been indicted. Over 40 criminal indictments. This grand jury, the first to actually look into Tom DeLay, discovering, yeah, Tom DeLay, he was involved in this thing too. So anyhow, DeLay goes on to say in this interview with Sean Hannity, first of all, he says, Ronnie Earl has established no intent, no motive. Can't prosecute, you can't convict without a motive. So then he goes on to say, and I quote, so we had an opportunity in 2002. I wanted to redistrict the congressional seat, so I wanted to make sure and help gain a majority in the Texas House. So I came up with this idea to form a political action committee to raise money to get into state representative races so we could win seats. So he's saying it was his idea. Now, on the other hand, yesterday on Hardball, he said, that's TRIMPAC. TRIMPAC is not me. This is the Texas Republican Majority Political Action Committee. He says, that's not me. I was simply along with 4 other elected officials on an advisory board. They used my name as headliners for fundraisers. I had no idea what they were doing. But then on March 10th, 05... Austin American Statesman, quote, U.S. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, Republican from Sugarland, said Wednesday it was his idea to create Texans for a Republican majority. And, of course, last night on Fox News, he said it was his idea. March 10th, 2004, Houston Chronicle, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay said Wednesday he served as creator, advisor, and fundraiser to a Texas-based political action committee now under state criminal investigation. This is one of the earlier grand juries that was looking into the criminal activities of the committee itself, where they actually did find crimes and did indict people. This from TRIMPAC itself, Q&A for potential media inquiries from the TRIMPAC website. Who is leading Texas for Republican majority? Answer, the leadership of the PAC includes Representative Tom DeLay. And then, as the New York Times reported back in March of this year, documents which were entered into evidence last week in a related civil trial in Austin, the state capital, suggest that Mr. DeLay personally forwarded at least one large corporate check to the committee, Texans for a Republican Majority, and that he was in direct contact with lobbyists for some of the nation's largest companies on the committee's behalf. And this, it turns out, this crime that was only outed, apparently only happened last year, was only outed in March of this year, is what he has been indicted for. Pretty amazing, huh? 1-866, I mean, just the audacity, if nothing else. But Tom DeLay is doing, other than going on Fox News and bragging that he started TRIMPAC and it was his idea, and they did it to raise money, other than that, which was a blunder, he is doing what high-profile folks are advised to do when they are indicted for criminal things, which is to try to sway the jury before the jurors even get into the courtroom, so that the average person has a storyline which is completely disconnected from reality, but says, oh, well, you know, this guy's just a political hack, the prosecutor, and he had to try over and over and over to get this guy, and they've been through 6 grand juries, blah, 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 blah. Even if it's not true at all, You get the average guy thinking that, and then you got a chance that that average guy is going to get on a jury. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Dave, in the trucker in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Name's Steve.
Oh, Steve, I'm sorry. Hey, Steve.
Okay, you answered the question. So five grand jurors before that had nothing to do with time delay, just to get that straight.
They were looking at Trimpeck.
They
indicted 40, I believe it was 44 people have been indicted now in the course of those five grand juries, yeah.
Okay, so it wasn't six grand juries to get Tom DeLay.
No, all along this has been about Trimpeck, not Tom DeLay. Trimpeck,
okay.
This political action committee that Tom DeLay helped create has been operating in violation of the laws of Texas. And, you know, 44 indictments. You've already got a couple of people who are buddies of Tom DeLay's who pled guilty.
Okay. I'll give you that. I'll take your word for it. But anyway, I'll give you
check
that.
It out.
That kind of undercuts my argument. But I mean, I was about to say that Tom DeLay is brash. He's a scorched earth politician, right? But
yeah.
I was just saying what the troubling part was is how many grand juries do you get to get somebody? And I think six grand juries with no. When it's just a prosecutor and a jury, and six times they don't find enough evidence.
You can't do that. You can't do that. You can't impanel a grand jury to look into one particular crime, and then if you don't find it, say, okay, we're going to try another grand jury. You just can't do it. It's against the law.
Okay, Well, that's what I heard, and if it's wrong, I'm sorry. I apologize. You undercut my argument.
Okay.
Sorry.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Tom in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Tom. We just have a few seconds left, actually.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. What about the Senate House rules? Doesn't a sitting congressman that gets indicted, don't they have to resign?
Well, the Republican rules say that he can't hold a leadership position. I don't know about the House rules themselves, but apparently not, you know, or we would have heard about it before now. But where it gets really interesting, Tom, and I'll get into this after the break, is why Roy Blunt and what happened to David Dreyer? And what's going on with Bill Frist? I'm telling you, with Bill Frist right now, I'm seeing the fingerprints of Karl Rove all over this thing, what's going on with Bill Frist. I got to tell you, here I am defending Bill Frist. I'll tell you after the break. It's 27 minutes after the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Yeah, he's been kicked out of the house. He's in the hall now. The bug-eyed, bug-killer Tom DeLay, he's toast as House Majority Leader right now. But he's still I guarantee he will still be a political force to be reckoned with, because this guy has the dirt on so many people. He has so much power. The other thing that I find fascinating, I mean, here you've got DeLay going down, and apparently for good reason. And, you know, we've known for a long time that Tom DeLay is that in Tom DeLay's world, that his party winning is more important than what's best for the United States. It's more important than what's best for his state of Texas. It's more important than it's more important to him than what's best for his district of Sugar Land, Texas. His party winning trumps everything. That's called broadly partisanship. And, you know, it's kind of an infectious disease. James Madison warned about it in Federalist Number 10 way back when, 1787. You know, look out for factions, the power of factions. They could destroy democracy. And here we are. And, Bill Clinton even appointed a Republican as Secretary of Defense, Bill Cohen. But no, that's never going to happen in this administration. In fact, this administration, the Bush administration, and their cronies like Tom DeLay are so committed to my way or the highway that I think that they're going after Bill Frist. Now, you may think I'm nuts here, but hear me out. First of all, Bush's worldview, and I think this is not just a statement. I don't think that this was just, you know, George Bush thumping his chest. I think that this is a real, genuine, honest statement of his worldview.
Either with us or against us, you're either evil or you're good.
And I think in George Bush's world, you're either a friend of his and you would lay down on in front of a truck and die for him, or you're the enemy and you're evil. And there is no there's no in between. And there's a very small number of people who are with us, with him, and everybody else is evil and on the outside against him. And Bill Frist, who had been on the inside, then comes out and says, you know, this stem cell thing. Now, Bill Frist is a physician. He's an MD. Guy's no dummy. He says, you know, this stem cell thing, I just can't play this charade anymore. Of kowtowing to the folks who are essentially and fundamentally opposed to birth control, as well as abortion. And he says, you know, we should be doing something with stem cell research. Contradicting George Bush. In that moment, Bill Frist went from being on the inside to the outside. He went from being with him to being against him. He went from being good to being evil in George Bush's mind, in my opinion.
Either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
See? And bang, just like that, that fast. And then the stories started appearing in the right-wing blogosphere, and this is what I'm seeing Karl Rove's fingerprints all over, about how Hospital Corporation of America, HCA, the company that Bill Frist's daddy started that's worth billions, that made his father one of the richest, one of the 50 richest men in America, a multi-billionaire, who is his brother, Thomas, is the president of, and that Bill Frist himself owns a lot of stock in, millions of dollars worth of stock in his blind trust, that HCA... Now, keep in mind, Bill Frist wants to run for president in 2008, and he wants the support of religious conservatives. That HCA, the story started coming out that HCA is one of the largest providers of abortions in the United States. And I'm of the opinion, and I may be wrong, I mean, you know, sometimes I am on these things, but it just seems to me a curious coincidence. I'm of the opinion that that was leaked, or not leaked, flogged by the Rove machine, and that that's the reason why Bill Frist was in such a tizzy that he called up the guy who's running his blind trust and said, sell all the HCA stock. Not just some of it, sell all of it. Because I think that he wanted, you know, 2 years from now or whatever, he wanted to be able to say, I don't own any stock in that company that does abortions. Now, unfortunately, see, this is a completely different story than the main story that's being played out in the press. We'll see which one it is. But unfortunately, the company's stock tanked 2 weeks later, dropped, what, 8%, 9%, something like that, because the company announced that their earnings were down. And a lot of the insiders in the company have been selling their stock, and it's starting to look like, you know, the people on the inside of the company knew that the earnings report was going to be bad, and so they sold their stock. Now, that's exactly what Martha Stewart was charged with originally. They didn't get her for it. They couldn't prove it. They charged her instead with lying about something related to, you know, in her being interviewed by the FBI. And that's what she served her 6 months for. But the original charge against her was insider trading, that she was a friend of, you know, Sam Wexel, who was the president of who had started this biotech company, and Sam had told her, hey, you know, this new drug that we're coming out with, it doesn't work. The stock price is going to drop, and, you know, sell your stock, and Martha sold her stock, and that was the story, right? And Bill Frist unloaded an amount of HCA stock that was 114 times more stock, more dollars, than the amount of stock that Martha Stewart unloaded. So the story, the main story that's out there, is that Bill Frist sold his stock because he knew it was going to tank. I'm skeptical of that. And I realize that I'm departing from, you know, my progressive brothers and sisters on this. I don't think Bill Frist is that dumb or that greedy. Now, he may well be. And, you know, as I said, I mean, this is just idle speculation more than a strong, convinced theory. But I think that Bill Frist is more concerned about his political future than he is about his economic wealth and well-being. I don't, you know, there are some folks who are obsessive about money. And they will do anything for the next penny. And even when they're millionaires and billionaires, they still, you know, are obsessing on money. And they're afflicted, I think, with the psychological disorder of obsessive-compulsive disorder, and the object of their obsession is money. And I think the Native American societies and indigenous societies around the world are right in saying that the excessive acquisition of stuff is a mental illness. But Bill Frist was born into this. I think his father has this. I think, you know, maybe his brother has it, but I'm not sure that he does. I think Bill Frist's goal is power. He wants political power. And he saw owning that HCA stock, that abortion company stock, as an obstacle to his having power. And he realized that Karl Rove was punishing him for his stem cell position. So, time will tell. We'll see. But that's my take on it. Maybe I'm wrong, but somehow I doubt it. But if I'm right, then what's going to play out is that Frist will be investigated, and they'll find out that he had no insider information, didn't have access to any inside information, or didn't use whatever access he might have had, and that he really didn't know that the stock was going to tank. And then the whole story of he was getting rid of the stock because Karl Rove was punishing him for his stem cell thing, that'll never come out. So I figured I'd just tell you in advance. Jeff in Canton, Ohio on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
I think, Tom, the reason why they have so much trouble with delay, I mean, you know, remember B1 Bob Dornan from California said it best. He said about Tip O'Neill, he said, if Mars has landed on the Earth, it'd take about 5 minutes to figure out who the hell was in charge.
Yeah, and it was Tip O'Neill at the time, yeah.
That's right. And I just don't think the speaker's strong enough, and this man, I'm more or less just steamrolled. Now,
yeah.
Concerning Mr. Frist, I think Joseph Kennedy said it right. He said, we got to hurry up and make as much money as possible before they make this illegal.
Yeah.
That's how the Kennedys made their money. I
well,
mean, the sound
sort of, yeah.
From,
yeah. Sort of.
And, you know, it's wrong what he did, but, you know, I think you're right concerning Mr. Rove. I mean, they play hardball.
Oh, yeah.
In politics. That's why they're in power. I mean, the Democrats got to learn to do the same. I mean, you can't sit there and think it isn't about being right or wrong in Washington, D.C. It's about winning and losing.
Well, tragically, and that's the problem. I mean, this is the problem that, for example, Native Americans were faced with. You know, they didn't have a tradition of fight, of genocide, of fight an enemy and then kill them all off. And so it was like, you know, faced with this, what do? You become the enemy? And a lot of Democrats are saying, no, we're not going to become like the Republicans. We're going to hold to the ideals of this country and wait for America to wake up. And I honor that. It's a losing strategy over the short term, but over the long term, it may be the thing that will save the republic.
Well, you know, it's like I have a lot of arguments with my Republican friends. I tell them, I said, you know, I think what the American people hunger for is competence. I mean, Mr. Clinton could have had sex with that cat. And if he was able to run against the people they got in there now, he would win going away.
Oh, yeah.
Because people want competent people running things.
Yeah.
And that's what they have seen. And, you know, I'm just worried about the country as a whole, just on what they're doing to our currency, because I just think within 10 years, at current spending levels,
we're toast.
Going to go the way of the peso.
Yeah.
What's going to happen.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Jeff. And thanks for the call. And that's just the bubbling surface of it. I don't know if you saw the report that credit card debt has now reached record levels, and credit card defaults, people who are not defaults yet, but people who are behind on their credit card payments, is my recollection. I don't have it in front of me. Is from like 4.0% up to 4.6%. Something. It's creeping up there. And why? Well, because gas prices are going through the roof. People can't afford to pay their bills. There's so many people just living on the edge in the United States. And this increase in gas prices, not to mention a 10% annual increase in health care costs. Now the average family in America is spending $10,880 a year. New study from the Kaiser Family Foundation. $10,880 a year on health care, on health care insurance. It's nuts. It's eating us up. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
People try to put us to death.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And let's see, Kevin in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to point out how, you know, Americans in general, whether they're poor, rich, or middle class, we're basically fooled into believing how well we have it here. And the reason why I'm saying this is because if you notice, luxury items are pretty much subsidized. We can get CD players, flat screen TVs easily. You know, even the poor.
Yeah, this is the point that I make over and over, Kevin, is that we have not ended slave labor in the United States. We have simply exported it.
But then again, the things that build our civilization, like healthcare, educated workforce, transportation, is not being subsidized.
That's right. These are all the things that the Republicans, the conservative Democrats are going after, the conservatives in general are going after. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why would they want to destroy the fabric of civil society? And the answer is very simple. They don't believe in civil society.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just that simple. Some of them will come right out and say it. I mean, you know, we get the folks from Ayn Rand who come out and they'll tell you, we don't believe in democracy. They'll just say it right, you know, they'll say it honestly. And then you get, you know, the weasels who subscribe to that philosophy but want to, you know, own up to it, you know, the Norquists of the world, and they'll say, oh, yeah, we're all in favor of democracy, but no, we don't think that we should be paying for fixing bridges and schools and, you know, things like, no, that's socialism. That's you know, terrible stuff. So that's the bottom line. Kevin, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Al in Miami Island, Florida. What is that, Merritt Island, Florida? Al? Whoops. No, not Al. I'm sorry. Got it. There we go. Al in Merritt Island, Florida. Hey, Al.
Hey.
What's up?
Okay. When you went to commercial a little while ago, I switched over to Rush Limbaugh, and he said he's looking at the indictment for Tom DeLay.
Right.
And he says, there's no charges in there except conspiracy.
Right.
There's nothing. Okay.
Is a crime.
Well, of course, I understand.
So how can you say there's no charge except conspiracy? That's like saying, this rapist has been charged with nothing except rape.
Yeah, but they're not explaining what the conspiracy was, apparently. And
actually, they are. They, in fact, there's a photo of the check on several of the websites out there for which Tom DeLay is being prosecuted.
Okay.
It's a $100,000 check.
And the moderator mentioned about all these statements that DeLay had made previously is about, I'm part of this party, I'm part of this organization, I started this fundraising group, et cetera, et cetera. Is that in the indictment?
No, of course not. I shouldn't say of course not. I haven't read the indictment, but what you're getting there is the right-wing spin.
Of course, I understand that.
Not just the right-wing spin for the purposes of politics and partisan stuff. It is for the purpose of influencing a future jury.
I understand that. Yeah, I just like to listen to Rush because I tend to get a feeling when he's lying. And then I want to go someplace to try to figure out what he's lying about, because I've caught him in so many lies.
Yeah, well, it happens. It happens.
Yeah.
Al, thanks
a
lot.
So he's not really technically lying here. There are no charges other than conspiracy.
Well, I don't know. As I said, I have
no definition of it.
I can't say. I haven't read the indictment. I'm sorry. Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to know, if the conviction of Tom DeLay is not very likely, and similarly with Karl Rove, then aren't these actually just witch hunts? Doesn't there have to be some kind of great possibility that this will become a conviction?
Well, you can't get a grand jury to issue an indictment unless you can demonstrate that there is a reasonable probability that a crime has been committed.
Yeah, but how likely do you think this conviction will be?
I from what I've seen of the photo of the check, and I mean this guy has been doing this for a long time. The Westar executives, remember when Westar the intercepted email that was in all the newspapers about, you know, where the Westar executive says, you know, we'd like to meet with Tom DeLay, but he says we got to give him $25,000, and the other guy says fine, give him the money. I mean, you know, there is a huge paper trail on this guy.
Well, when is this going to play out? That's my question, actually.
Oh, well, I don't know the timeline.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling, Logan. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Bill in, is it Tenasket, West Washington?
Yes, that's correct.
Hey, Bill.
Hey. I was curious about your thoughts on what you had said on your opening bit about the creeping fascism. I mean, I feel kind of like we're the frog in the pot here in the United States.
And the water's getting hotter and hotter.
Yeah, and we're not doing anything about it.
Well, actually, we are right here. And you and I were having this conversation, and that's a very significant thing. It wasn't happening 2-3 years ago.
That is true. My question, though, because you have a much greater breadth of knowledge and I suspect access to information that most of us don't have, just because of the folks you know and people you talk to, how do you feel the rest of the world is going to react to us as we head more and more towards this fascist state?
Well, I can tell you, Bill, the rest of the world is already freaked out. I gave a speech at Oxford University a year or so ago, and you know, I got up in front of, 200-300 students and faculty and whatnot, and I was talking about corporate personhood, which is a rather abstract thing. I mean, this is mostly law students, and the parallels between corporate personhood in England and the United States. And before I could get five sentences out of my mouth, these people were yelling at me as if it was Prime Minister's questions, you know, whether or not I supported George Bush. And I said, and there was this silence, and I said, I just want you to know, George W. Bush does not speak for me. I think the guy is nuts. I think he's dangerous. I think his policies are destructive to the United States, and I do not support him. I did not vote for him. And there, I got a standing ovation. And then they allowed me to give my speech. I mean, that's the kind of intensity that's out there. That's the country that's our ally. So it's out there. I'm telling you, the people are all around the world are looking at us right now, and they're going, whoa, there's really scary stuff going on here in the United States. They're in the United States, you know, pointing to us, and they're very, very concerned. Look at what happened just in the last 2 days, an article in the New York Times about Karen Hughes. She goes over to Saudi Arabia and meets with women and says, you know, we're here to bring you Western-style democracy. And they say, we don't want it, thank you very much. And she's like, what? I mean, this administration, these guys, they are so arrogant. They are so disconnected from reality. They just think everybody in the world wants to be just like Texas. And then if they don't want it, we'll bomb them into it.
Go figure. You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6.5 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We have lost control. It says France's finance minister, Thierry Breton. He had a private meeting with Alan Greenspan, and he told reporters, this is a Reuters story out of Washington, D.C., he told reporters that Greenspan said to him, this is the finance minister for France, says that Alan Greenspan said to him, and I quote, here's the actual quote from Breton, he says, "We have lost control," that was his expression. "The United States has lost control of their budget at a time when racking up huge deficits have been authorized without any control from Congress. We are both disappointed that the management of debt is not a political priority today." End quote. Serious problem. Serious problem. This from the Reuters story. Treasury Secretary John Snow said the U.S. administration is still committed to having its budget deficit by 2009. Yeah, right. Breton said the situation that is creating tension on today's currency market is clearly American deficit. Remember Dick Cheney saying before the election in 2000, Ronald Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. Ronald Reagan threw this nation into such massive debt that the only way out of it was to borrow from the Social Security Trust Fund, which he did. He initiated and it was Greenspan's suggestion, actually, as Ravi Batra documents in his book Greenspan's Fraud. So now we have, 25 years, Yeah, 25 years of conservative economic policies with a little, maybe 5-6 year island there where Bill Clinton got some control over the budget. But by and large, 25 years of conservative economic policies, and what has it brought us? Bankruptcy for our federal government and, you know, at the personal level. It's personal bankruptcies right now. All-time high. Part of it, of course, is people trying to get in under the October 17, I believe it is, window. The folks in the Gulf states, New Orleans, Mississippi, Louisiana, not going to be so fortunate. You can't file bankruptcy if you can't get your paperwork together. You can't get your paperwork together if it got washed away in your house. Nobody in Congress wants to do anything about that. By the way, the Tom DeLay indictment. Just, you know, I'll just share with you some of the language of it. It's very straightforward. Grand jury of the County of Travis, State of Texas, duly selected, organized, sworn, charged as of the April term, AD 2005, blah, de, blah, de, blah. All these names, you know, the jurors and all that, blah, de, blah, de, blah. Says the defendants herein, with the intent that a felony be committed, did enter into an agreement with one or more of each other, or with a general purpose political committee known as Texans for a Republican Majority, PAC, that one or more of them would engage in conduct that would constitute the offense of knowingly making a political contribution in violation of subchapter D of chapter 253 of the Texas Election Code, violation of subsection 253, you know, blah, de, blah, de, blah, is that said contribution was made directly to the Republican National Committee, a political party, during a period beginning 60 days before the date of the general election, blah, de, blah, de, blah, and that such contribution included a prohibited political contribution by a corporation, and the John Donathan Calandro and James Walter Ellis and Texans for Republican Majority PAC did perform overt acts in pursuant of the agreement, to wit, John Calandro and Texans for Republican Majority did accept contributions from corporations, namely Diversified Collection Services, Inc. in the amount of $50,000, and Sears Roebuck & Company in the amount of $25,000, and Williams Companies, Inc. in the amount of $25,000, and Cornell Companies in the amount of $10,000. You want to know specifics. And Bacardi USA, Inc. in the amount of $20,000, and Quistera Corporation in the amount of $25,000. And James Ellis and Texans for Republican Majority PAC did tender, deliver, and cause to be tendered and delivered to the Republican National Committee, and Terry Nelson, a representative of the Republican National Committee, a check, a copy of which is hereinafter reproduced, payable to the Republican National State Elections Committee, a non-federal component of the Republican National Committee, in the amount of $190,000, said check being from the same bank account into which the above-described corporate contributions have been deposited. Sounds to me like they're laying out a crime. I mean, I don't see how, you know, Limbaugh can spin this beyond, well, you know, yeah, okay, they committed a crime. There it is, right there. And in fact, here's a photo of the check. I'm looking at it right now. Here, it's September 13, 2002, RNSEC, $190,000. The grand jury further presents that with the advice and consent of counsel, the defendant Thomas Dale DeLay, Tom DeLay, did heretofore knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive the application of Articles 12.01 and 12.03 of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure to the indictment presented herein, in particular the grand jury present that with advice and consent of counsel, the defendant, Thomas Dale DeLay, did knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive the requirement that an indictment for the felony offense of criminal conspiracy, the object of which is a felony other than those listed in subsections 1 through 5, blah-de-blah, may be presented within 3 years from the date of the commission of the offense, blah-de-blah-de-blah. I mean, it's just, bang. They just nail this stuff down. I mean, they got a photograph of the check. You can see all this at thesmokinggun.com, by the way. And tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room who pointed it out to me. You can get to our chat room by going to tomhartman.com and just click on live chat if you'd like to drop in there and say hello. Is Ronnie Earle this evil partisan guy? Well, let's see. He's prosecuted four times as many Democrats as Republicans over his 27-year tenure. His public integrity unit has prosecuted 15 elected officials, 12 Democrats. Maybe he is partisan. As a Republican. In fact, several of his assistants have gone on to run for political office as Republicans. Some of the Democrats prosecuted by Earl and his Public Integrity Unit are former House Texas House Speaker Gib Lewis, former Texas Attorney General Jim Maddox, former State Treasurer Warren Harding, and former Texas Supreme Court Justice Don Yarbrough. A friend of a local official targeted by Earl called him a Boy Scout. Democrats, for their part, are still upset over the prosecution of Attorney General Jim Maddox for bribery in 1985. He was acquitted, and years later, Jim Marston, a civil lawyer in Austin and a friend of Mr. Maddox, asked Ronnie Earl why he went ahead with a questionable case. I said, Ronnie, how can it be an abuse of power to threaten a lawyer? We threaten each other all the time. He told me that elected officials are held to a higher standard. They are supposed to be above suspicion, like Caesar's wife. It was then that Mr. Marston realized, this is from the Christian Science Monitor, it was then that Mr. Marston realized how deep Earl's principles run. Ronnie Earl is a Boy Scout who is offended by wrongdoings, chief among them public officials' abuse of power. In the same article in the Christian Science Monitor, the author notes, deliberate in the capital cases he sends to juries, Earl is well known for examining an issue from all angles before acting. Says Marston, if I have any complaint about Ronnie, it's that he's overly cautious about who he prosecutes. The fact that it has taken 2 years to investigate Tom DeLay is not a sign of partisanship, but of being completely careful. To those who know him, Earl has always exhibited a strong moral streak, from his formative years growing up in a small town outside Fort Worth to his time in the Austin Night Court to his political service in the state legislature, but they contend his morality is tempered by his compassion. Ronnie is principled and will do the right thing, even if it isn't the smartest political thing to do, says Ellen Halbert, a victim's rights advocate. Keep in mind, this guy's the prosecutor. Bill Reed, an attorney who worked for Earl, retired in 1997, says, one of the things I admire most about Ronnie Earl is his indefatigable ability to go and meet with groups all over town all the time, right-wing groups, left-wing groups, the Rotary. He's not a bloodthirsty prosecutor who wanted to get notches in his gun. There are some who have a reputation for walking close to the line in terms of evidence and rights, but there was never a push or inclination from him that we ought to bend the rules. Working for him, I was doing what I wanted to do, and I could go home and sleep at night. The Houston Chronicle, speaking of Ronnie Earl, Travis County prosecutor, says the record does not support allegations that Earl is prone to partisan witch hunts. But Tom DeLay is going to get it out there, and all of his handmaidens are going to get it out there that this is just a liberal witch hunt by a Democrat who just happens to have prosecuted 12 out of the 15 public elected officials he's prosecuted in the last 27 years. 12 of them just happen to be Democrats. Yeah, he's a very partisan guy. This is just a witch hunt. Yeah, don't pay any attention. No attention whatsoever to that man behind the curtain.
No attention to that man behind the curtain.
Don't even look at him. Don't even look at him. Yes. Just keep listening to right-wing talk radio, and eventually you won't need a lobotomy. No, please don't. Don't. 16 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends.
Monty, this seems strange to me. The movies had that movie thing, but nonsense has a welcome ring, and heroes don't come.
And welcome back. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Lots going on. John Roberts ascends to power. Tom DeLay falls from the throne. I haven't actually even gotten to on the program yet to the whole thing with, you know, who's going to replace him, and who's going to replace Sandra Day O'Connor now.
Well, we don't know, and I'm at the White House today, and we asked a lot of questions about that. Scott McClellan was jubilant, beaming from ear to ear, and he gave us great details that John Roberts was at the White House for the vote, watched it on, you know, on the TV, and the president even watched a little bit of it, and they're having lunch with the two wives, and he'll be sworn in at 3 o'clock. But, of course, we all ask questions about the next nominee, and he wouldn't say, and he just talked about the process. Now, I asked what I thought was kind of an interesting question. I thought so anyway. I asked whether, had Judge Roberts' name come up during consultations with Democratic senators? And he said that it had, which is interesting because I know of at least one Democratic senator who said that it hadn't come up with him. So then I said,
no,
so,
wait a second. I don't understand what you're talking about here. Do you mean before Roberts' name was put into nomination? Okay.
Exactly.
In other words, did they test his name with, like Orrin Hatch actually suggested Ruth Bader Ginsburg to Bill Clinton and Stephen Breyer?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
So that was what I was asking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, he said that the name had come up. Now, that was interesting because Senator Schumer had said some time ago in a press conference that Roberts' name had not come up when he was there, so maybe it was just Schumer. So then, obviously, I asked whether the next nominee's name had come up in consultations with Democratic senators or whether the names on the shortlist had come up with Democratic senators, to which he replied, good question.
In other words, he's not going to tell you.
No, you're not going to tell me. So then other members of the press corps started chiming in. Answer her question.
Well, good on you, Victoria.
So then I'm saying, so I said, is there a short list? I said, how many on it? Five, four, three? And we didn't get any answers today.
Yeah, yeah.
But we tried for you, Tom.
Well, we know that George W. Bush has essentially assured Alberto Gonzalez that he'll have a seat on the Supreme Court. And the question in my mind is, how confident is Bush that sometime in the next 2.5 years, 3 years, before his term expires, there will be another opening on the court, that he can postpone putting Gonzalez in and play to his base right now, not burn his bridges behind him? Apparently, you know, the right wing is very concerned about Gonzalez's position on abortion.
Right.
Although, you know, Gonzalez is the guy who says, you know, we don't need no stinking laws to throw people in jail, right? I mean, it's talk about being a right winger. But in any case, you know, how can he postpone his promise to Gonzalez? Because I believe he'll keep it. You know, I believe that, you know, Bush really lives in a world of black and white. You're on the inside or you're on the outside. You're either part of his inner circle or you're the enemy. And that he's going to elevate Gonzalez to that. But is there going to be somebody else in the interim? And will that be Priscilla Owen, frankly, is my best guess.
Yes, I mean, it's a huge question. Questions were asked about whether it would be a woman and, you know, gender and diversity. We have absolutely no idea. I mean, I would think that the president may think it is a fairly safe bet that somebody else is going to go. But for it to be one of the Democrats on the bench or one of the so-called left-leaning members of the bench, they're going to hang on. You know, they're going to bring coffins into work with them fairly soon. They're not going.
Yeah. Yeah,
unless they have to.
Well, but that's the thing. I mean, you've got John Paul Stevens, who's now, what, 85?
Yes, and he will swear in John Roberts.
Yeah, because he's the senior member of the court. But,
right.
But he's also 85.
He is.
That's really pushing it. And
yes,
Ruth Bader Ginsburg has had cancer.
Right.
And, I mean, I think probably, you know, the only ones who are in pretty good health, you know, reliably good health, are Souter, Scalia, and Thomas.
What about Kennedy? Is he fairly healthy?
Well, you know, I don't know.
He's
getting up there. He's in his 70s,
yeah.
Isn't he?
Oh, that's young for the court.
I see. Yeah, okay. Historically. Yeah. So we'll see how this plays out. And now, Roy Blunt.
But I kind of, we were assured, now I hope this is true, we were assured that the next nominee would not be announced today.
Oh, the next nominee for the court?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, Roy Blunt is taking Tom DeLay's place in the House of Representatives?
Yes, that's right, he is. Although the Republicans are not exactly saying that it's a replacement. They're very much trying to make it seem as though he's just keeping his seat warm.
Yeah. And any sense of how long it's going to be before there's any action on this indictment? How long is it going to be? You know, I mean, are we looking at a court case here in 3 months, 6 months, 2 years, 5 years, what?
Yeah, I haven't heard anything in terms of how long it's going to be, and I would imagine that I'm just trying to think whether DeLay would want it quick, or I think you probably want it fairly quick, actually.
Well, I read the indictment. You know, the indictment has an actual copy of the check attached
to
it. It's like, you know, I would think that he would want to stretch it out as long as he can and hope he dies of old age first, because it looks to me like they're going to nail him.
It doesn't look good. It really does not look good for him. And the fact is, even if they don't nail him, he is, as a leader, he's finished.
Yeah, but Ronnie Earl, I mean, the more you read about him, the more you learn about him. This guy's very careful, very methodical, very thoughtful, and, you know, he doesn't just go blazing from the hip.
As is Fitzgerald doing the probe into Valerie Plame.
Yeah, that's another one that's going to be coming up. That'll be interesting, too. Okay, Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you. Thanks.
Have a good one. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
My friend Greg says it's all good.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, for all things Macintosh. You get the latest iPod, and for all things computer, PCs as well. Service, sales, support, 1-800-511-MACS. What did John Roberts do in Florida? This is fascinating. This is Danny Schechter on MediaChannel.org. Did the nominee, did Judge John Roberts help obstruct a recount? And in Florida, and there's, sure enough, there's a picture of him as being part of the gang of people who were in Miami-Dade County building with the GOP activists led by propagandist Jim Wilkinson banging on the windows saying, "Stop the count, stop the count." This is pretty amazing. this is very amazing. And was his therefore was his nomination payback for the political work he did in the trenches in Florida? Danny Schechter says, so it's not surprising that there have been few media investigations into John Roberts as a partisan activist in an attempt to undermine an important recount. Do we really know the mind of that stealth ideologue dressed in that black robe? Being cordial and having a photogenic family is not qualification for running for the highest court in the land for life. Henry Kissinger also went for Harvard. It's interesting. Boy. Danny Schechter just lays out, there's just a whole pile of stuff here about Robert's political and highly partisan activities. Tragically coming out here at the very last minute. Unfortunately, this didn't come out. And this story was published today. I mean, I'm sure that's what they've been doing, you know, holding their breath, get it through at the very last minute. Let's see what happens, you know, get it out there. Now we've got Roy Blunt. Now, to shift gears from back to Tom DeLay. One of the things I found was really fascinating was a correspondence sequence I had yesterday, or that I saw, stuff flying by in email. And by the way, let me just take a moment here to say, I'm now getting, I don't know, 50, 100, maybe 150 emails a day, it'll depend on the day, from listeners who want to either debate me about an issue or who want to make a comment, hey, you know, you were really right about that, or hey, did you know about that, you know, that sort of thing. And I used to, you know, first year or so of this program, we were on a smaller number of stations. I used to try and always answer them. I've just reached the point where I can't anymore. I'm sorry. It's you know, there's such a huge pile of them, and my generic answer would be, in any case, call the show. You know, if you want to say something, you want to ask a question, if you want to make a point, if you want to make a comment, you want to let off some steam, call the show. I'll put you on the air. You want to argue with me? You want to contradict me? I love it. Call the show. And we'll put you on the air. So, you know, if you sent me an email, odds are I've read it. But please, if you didn't get a response, don't be offended. I just, you know, it's turned into 3-4 hour a day job just reading my email, and I still do it, and I can't answer it all anymore. But anyway, back to my email. Yesterday, after Tom DeLay announced that he was stepping down, a word came that David Dreyer was going to be taking his place. David Dreyer was going to fill in for him. And within minutes, well, within 15 or 20 minutes, I received an email that was blasted out of Washington, D.C. by a person fairly well connected in Democratic Party circles, and not an elected person, and that said, that had a whole bunch of links to stories, particularly in the San Francisco Chronicle, saying that it's an open secret in Washington, D.C., that David Dreyer, the Republican congressman from California, is gay and has been living with his chief of staff for many, many years. His chief of staff is very well paid. And that in and of itself, nothing wrong with that. In fact, you know, God bless him. A guy in public service who's, you know, who's gay, fine. You know. However, he's part of the Republican Party. He goes along with the gay bashing chorus. He's doing the same thing that J. Edgar Hoover did. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover's lover, Clyde Tolson, they lived it was an open secret in Washington, D.C. They lived in an apartment with lace doilies and antiques and two little dogs, and they twice a year went down to Florida, and Clyde Tolson, J. Edgar Hoover's partner, liked to dress in drag. And, you know, pretty much everybody knew this, but still, they prosecuted gays in the FBI and drove them out of the bureau. So David Dreyer, the hypocrite. And now I understand recently he's gotten married and had a child, and his chief of staff, is he still around or not? I don't know the latest story, but anyhow, this was all laid out in this email. And I know that it didn't just go out to me. I mean, you know, this went out to the media, it went out to politicians. And 15 minutes after that, all of a sudden, nobody's talking about David Dreyer anymore. Now, nobody in the media is telling the story of what was in this email. I mean, I'm telling you right now, this is what happened behind the scenes in Washington, D.C. This is what you won't hear on Hardball or on, you know, on any of the, if network stuff. That basically what was being said, and frankly, I don't know if it was the Republicans or the Democrats who were engineering this thing. I mean, I don't know where it originated. As I said in the first hour of this program, I suspect that right now Bill Frist is the victim of a Karl Rove smear. So I don't know if David Dreyer was being attacked by people within the Republican Party because he's gay and in the closet, or if they were concerned that he may be vulnerable and therefore he shouldn't become the majority leader. And so they thought they'd kind of leak this. I mean, keep in mind, Karl Rove has a long history of leaking the bad stuff in advance so that then you can attack the messenger. You know, George W. Bush is being accused of not having served his, done his service in the National Guard. Get some documents proving that. Leak them to Dan Rather and then knock him down. Because you leaked them, you can knock him down. Because you know that there, you know, that there's something wrong with them. Or maybe not. Who knows? But, you know, you set it up and knock it over. I mean, Karl Rove has a, you know, this is, you know, not a new trick. It just, you know, get it out there and get it over with. So it might be that this was something that was initiated by the Republicans. In any case, immediately after this, no more discussion about David Dreyer. Now, all of a sudden, it's Roy Blunt. Roy Blunt, at least, is not gay. But David Dreyer, at least, is not corrupt, as far as anybody can tell. Or as far as I can tell. I mean, he's a conservative Republican. He toes the party line. But, you know, apparently he is, again, as far as I can tell, he's not, you know, one of the most corrupt politicians in Washington, D.C. Roy Blunt is. This is from the Washington Post article, but from the Washington Post by Ray Vahendi, or Jim Vahendi by Vandehei, excuse me. Only hours after Representative Blunt was named to the House's third highest leadership job in November, this is a story from back a year ago, June. He surprises fellow top Republicans by trying to quietly insert a provision benefiting Philip Morris USA into the 475-page bill creating the Department of Homeland Security. Now, why would he be trying to slip a Philip Morris rider into the Homeland Security bill? Well, it turns out that Roy Blunt had been married for 31 years to the same woman, divorced her to pick up with a woman who he had been, shall we say, seeing, who had an affiliation with Philip Morris. And his son is a lobbyist for Philip Morris. Now, Denny Hastert actually pulled that provision out of that bill. This, according to the Washington Post, the provision would have made it harder to sell tobacco products over the Internet. See, this cuts into the profits of Philip Morris. The article in the Washington Post goes on to say Blunt has received large campaign donations from Philip Morris. His son works for the company in Missouri, and the House member has a close personal relationship with a Washington lobbyist for the firm. Now, keep in mind, this is a 2003 story. That would be the woman who he left his wife for. So several in that circle say they were struck by Blunt's willingness to go out on a limb for a country to which he has ties. Well, you know, you're sleeping with their lobbyist. Is that more than ties? Who knows? In April, for instance, Blunt managed to have a provision inserted into a Senate bill without debate on behalf of United Parcel Service, Inc. and FedEx. The two companies are seeking to block expansion of a foreign rival's U.S. operations. Blunt's son, Andrew, also represents UPS in Missouri, as the Wall Street Journal first reported, and the two companies have contributed a total of $120,000 to Blunt since 2001, according to Federal Election Commission data. And that's what boggles my mind. When you go back and you look at the records of these people, and look at what Tom DeLay's being indicted for, $190,000 check. Bunch of companies, $20,000, $30,000, $50,000. These guys are so cheap. I mean, you've got corporations that are making billions. $1 billion is $1,000 million. They're making billions in profits, not just in revenue, in profits, as a result of laws that are being passed by these guys. And these guys are selling out for $1,000 here, $5,000 there, $10,000 someplace else. Here, Roy Blunt taking $120,000 from UPS and FedEx. I mean, it's just, I'm not saying, gee, he should be asking for more money. I'm just amazed at how little it takes to buy off Republicans, and presumably some of the Democrats as well, in this Congress. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Prophets are human nature, and Mother Nature, she tries to, but she's not doing very well, and that's no thanks to you. We could trust in your wisdom and all the things that you know, if we couldn't see the clear cuts from the road.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, and Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma on the line. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Tom. Well, you took some of my thunder away because I was going to talk about Blunt being sort of replacing DeLay with DeLay Light. But there are some other charges that are listed on the Citizens for Responsible Ethics in Washington's report on the 13 most corrupt members of Congress that also list a scheme to funnel money through a local party committee into Matt Blunt's campaign committee.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, this is he learned from the feet of the master on that one about washing money. Yeah. Not only that, but he also was involved in the Jack Abramoff gambling scandal for $8,500. You know, he supported that. You know, they sell out cheap. And then there was remember the trip to the golfing thing that DeLay got in trouble for? Well, Blunt took a trip to Korea paid for by a foreign agent, which is clearly prohibited by the laws, even if it's reimbursed later from a non-foreign agent. So there are a lot of things that need investigating. And one more thing, I read in roll call on the front page that it was objections of conservatives that got rid of Dreyer.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. As I said, I'm not sure where this thing originated, and it might have been that it was being passed along, you know, from a conservative source. And that's, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Thanks a lot,
right.
Glenn.
You
I appreciate
bet.
It. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Roy in Rio Rancho. Hey, Roy.
Hi, Tom. I'll just dovetail in on what Glenn was saying. I happened to see Tony Perkins being interviewed by the so-called newsman on Pat Robertson's 700 Club yesterday afternoon.
Tony Perkins, the head of the Family Research Council.
Family Research Council. Before Blount's appointment, or Roy Blount's appointment was announced, and that was Tony Perkins' man. No, we really want to see Roy Blount.
Yeah,
He's done us this, and he's done us that, and he's a good Christian man, and yada, 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 yada.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That was prior to the announcement, which I just kind of, not ironic, but kind of dovetails in with the conservatives getting rid of a in-the-closet gay fella.
Yep, so, there you go. Roy, anyway. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Rick in Michigan. Hey, Rick.
Well, Tom, do you think we're going to put the hammer in the slammer?
I think eventually. I mean, I read part of the indictment here on the air. You can see the picture of the check. It's over at smokinggun.com. It's pretty damning.
Well, I have to laugh at these conservatives who are saying, you know, that the presumption of innocence must be maintained here, and the prosecutor is a person of the other party who's a very zealous partisan.
Where were these guys when Bill Clinton was being pursued?
I was going to say, what happened to Ken Starr and Bill? And by the way, why are they calling him Ronnie? I don't remember people were calling Ken Kenny.
No, but Ronnie actually calls himself Ronnie.
It's just a Texas thing, huh?
Yeah, yeah. That's you know, it's like Bill, you know, instead of William.
Well,
yeah, so.
It's interesting, too, this Blount character. I didn't know all this information you just brought up, you know, but you can pretty much tell when you, and I watch a lot of C-SPAN, you know, I watch Bernie on there, and you can see these people and the way they talk and the way they look, and there just seems to be a hard-heartedness about it, you know. And I guess they're all Christians. Maybe Dreyer is a Christian, too. But then when you look under the surface, you know, I guess the word Christian is thrown around pretty easily nowadays. I guess you can just say you're one, and nobody has to really look at what you're about.
I suspect that's the case, and it certainly is not it's not what Jesus was teaching. You know,
absolutely
it's like,
not.
By their fruits they shall be known. And so,
amen, brother.
There you go. Okay, thanks a lot, Rick. Good to hear from you. Hey, Armin in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, what's up with old Phil Graham? Remember him talking about there's too many people riding in the wagon and there's not enough people pulling it? You think he's finally pulling the wagon, or what do you think he's up to?
Well, Phil Graham is out of public life now, isn't he? Isn't he a lobbyist?
Well, right, but remember his famous saying, he's the one, there's just too many people riding in the wagon and there's not enough people pulling it. Remember that when Clinton was in, that was Phil
sure.
Graham's famous?
Yeah.
So the question is he pulling the wagon or riding in it?
Oh, yeah. Well, who knows? You know, good point, Armin, but I don't know. I don't know. A good ironic question. We'll leave it at that. Nancy in Chicago. Hey, Nancy, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. You would recommend a day or so ago that you had recommended a site called Think Progressive, and you had said
Think Progress. Thinkprogress.org.
Got it. That, right.
Yeah.
And you had said that was one of the best arguments that you had read in regards to Mike Brown with, you know, perjuring himself.
Right.
Okay. I can't find that argument on the site.
Well, it's what happens. Think Progress is a blog, and every day it gets refreshed. And somewhere, either at the very top or the bottom, you can click for the archives to look at the previous day
That's
and the day
I've
before
done.
That.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And somewhere in there, I'm pretty sure is the whole, you know, everything that I was sharing with you on the air.
Well, tell me why you thought that it was one of the best articles, so I can get some insight as to what the content.
Well,
is.
Well, it actually quoted him. I mean, they pulled out of the. I actually printed out his testimony. It was like 55 pages.
Right.
And
right.
It quoted his testimony where he said that the governor had given him a list of counties that did not include the three counties that make up New Orleans,
right.
and that he was shocked by that, and that he decided to insert those counties anyway and go ahead. And that was a lie. It was just a plain old flat-out lie. It's a demonstrable lie, and in the article they had links to the original document, which is on the website of the governor's office for the state of Louisiana, and on the White House website, where the White House issued the proclamation, the original proclamation missing those counties, and then the later proclamation including them. So, you know, it was just a flat-out lie.
I saw that. You're absolutely correct. What he did is he was looking for specificity as opposed to general, and it was actually Mike Brown's unknowledgeable as to what the areas did incorporate.
Well, I think it went beyond that. I'm sorry, Nancy, we've got to wrap it up here. It's the end of the hour. But I think that the Republican who was leading him, and I don't recall which one it was now, it was from Indiana, as I recall, and Brown were basically putting out these Republican talking points. It was all the Democrats. That's the bottom line. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. 6.5 minutes after the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Well, John Roberts is now Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, a man elevated from beating on the windows where they were counting votes in Florida and coaching and coaching the lawyers for the Bush campaign on how to plead before the United States Supreme Court. Elevated from that to Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Pretty spooky stuff. Who's next? Well, I've been saying for a long time here, I think Alberto Gonzalez or Priscilla Owen, that's my short list. But, and both of them, corporatists. I mean, what we're seeing here is the relentless march of the merging of corporate and state interests. Benito Mussolini had a name for it, he called it fascism. In fact, in the 1987 American Heritage Dictionary, you can read the fascism, the merging of corporate and state interests combined with belligerent nationalism. Now, tell me that's not what we have or what we're moving in the direction of. And so it shouldn't surprise us, I suppose, that the lawyers, virtually all the lawyers who are being looked at, are, you know, corporatists. Larry D. Thompson, he's being talked about. He's the general counsel of PepsiCo. He's African-American. Judge Karen Williams, Orangeburg, South Carolina, sits on the Court of Appeals of the Fifth Circuit, for the Fourth Circuit, rather. Priscilla Owen, Janice Rogers Brown, consistently ruling in ways that are referred to in the press as conservative. Increasingly, for the press, the word conservative means they rule on the side of business interests. Because let us not forget, most of the press in the United States is a multi-billion-dollar business interest itself. Now that there are no longer community service standards, community service requirements in the United States, we'll see what happens with this. Interesting times we live in. An absolutely chilling story in the New York Times recently. Before the Iraq War, this is an article by Leslie Wayne titled U.S. Weapons, Foreign Flavor. Before the Iraq War, one of the Pentagon's biggest concerns was that American troops would face unknown biological and chemical threats. But when the order came in to step up production of a two-piece protective suit, the Pentagon had to look overseas to get all the parts, even to countries who opposed the war. The polyester fabric used by American companies to make the suits came from Germany and Austria. Finnish and British manufacturers made the eyelets and washers, while Japan provided the carbon beads in the suit's liner. Critical to the suit's protection was a fabric available only from one country, Germany, one of the war's strongest critics. You know, when World War II was declared, Franklin Roosevelt said, okay, that's it. General Motors, you've been making cars, you do a fine job, but right now you're going to stop making cars and you're going to start making tanks. And Boeing, you make a great commercial airliner, but you're going to be making airplanes for the military now. We made this transition from a peacetime economy to a wartime economy. It is this rapid transition. Can we do it? Can we do that now? We can't. We have outsourced and offshored so much of our, so much of the, you know, this kind of capability. We can't. We're not even producing our own military hardware any longer. And where are we getting a lot of this stuff from? From China. A potential competitor slash enemy of the United States. You know, China, Chinese army guy just, you know, last, what, month and a half ago, said 100 American cities would be nuked if we tried to defend Taiwan. In the meantime, we seem to be living on a increasingly tenuous shelf of oil. You know, walking out on the edge here, the thing that's propping us up, our food is essentially oil. It's converted into food through the use of tractors and the production of fertilizer and things. It's transported to us by oil. It's oil everywhere, right? It's the basis of our economy. It's the basis of our way of life right now. And Matthew Simmons, the author of Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock in the World Economy, I have some very specific thoughts about what the future of oil may be. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us, what is the basic premise of Twilight in the Desert?
Well, the basic premise is that we've created over the last three or four decades a concept that the Middle East, and in particular Saudi Arabia, had essentially unlimited amounts of oil that was almost, also almost free. And as long as we continue to grow and use more oil, the only thing we ever worried about is geopolitical events. And while there was almost no specific data that actually supported the fact that all these reserves and this plentiful oil was there, it was just a concept. And I came back from having studied the energy business for over three decades. I came back from a relatively brief trip to Saudi Arabia, and having arrived there, knowing that there were basically five key fields that made up 90% of their production, and there was enough discussion about these five fields that said they're struggling to make sure that they're actually, you know, continuing to produce what they are, that I came back and started searching for technical papers, found a treasure trove of technical papers. By the time I got through about 150 of them, I'd convinced myself that we were sitting on the world's greatest energy illusion. That, in fact, the amount of increased capacity in Saudi Arabia was very limited. And the risk that they might soon start into decline, the same way the United States did 35 years ago, was high enough to be a real risk. And that's what convinced me I needed to write a book.
Yeah, and you did a good job of it. Now, I wrote a book about the peak oil as well, called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and this was back in 86 that I wrote that, and back then I had found a story that in the trade press that talked about how Saudi Arabia in the early 1980s all of a sudden discovered about a third more oil than they had, and it coincided with a time when their purchasing of Western goodies, the increase in their lifestyle, was out exceeding their income, and they had to go to the World Bank to borrow money, and so then the oil was the collateral, and all of a sudden they discovered a whole bunch more oil. And, in fact, there was never any discovery. I assume that you're talking about this kind of stuff in here?
Yeah, I didn't actually, that's interesting for me. I didn't realize that they were actually, you know, borrowing money. I think that the tripling of their reserves came as a result of the fact that during the early 80s, when all of a sudden production quotas became important within the OPEC members, the UAE and Kuwait led the way in all of a sudden discovering that they had, instead of having 30 billion barrels each of proven reserves, they had 90 to 100. And then Iraq had 100, and as opposed to 30. And finally, late in the day, Saudi Arabia said, this is kind of amazing. They'd increased their number from 110 to 160, and then all of a sudden it became 260 overnight, so that it could fall in line with their other member countries.
Right. In other words, so that the production quota could be increased because it was stated as a percentage of your total oil.
Yeah,
Yeah, of your total proven reserves. Proven
right,
reserves
and,
don't mean much.
Right, and so they could pump more oil, they could get more money.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So now I've also read reports just in the last few months that Saudi crude is starting to get kind of dirty with water, indicating that they're pumping water. They're doing pumping water into some of these wells, indicating that these are aging wells.
Well, in fact, the reality is in the late 60s, they started, and they being the four owners of Aramco, which were Exxon, Chevron, Mobil, and Texaco, started realizing that they were starting to lose this fabulous high reservoir pressure. And so they began experimenting with injecting more than a barrel of water for every barrel of oil they produce so that they never created any what's called technically voidage in the reservoir. And today, from all best data, which is always skimpier than you'd like, they're pumping 15 to 18 million barrels of water into their 7 or 8 key oil fields to produce about 9 million barrels a day of crude.
And the consequences of that are?
Well, the consequences are they artificially created the illusion that there was never any depletion as they kept the reservoir pressure so high that they're actually sweeping the best oil out. Once it's gone, they're going to be left with a lot of additional oil, but it's going to be lesser quality oil coming out of lesser quality rocks, and a lot of it will have to be artificially lifted.
So you say the coming Saudi oil shock in the world economy. What does this mean for the world economy? When do you expect it to come?
Well, the world economy, unfortunately, was built on a key assumption that oil demand could grow from 80-plus million barrels today to 120, 125,
right.
130.
Matthew, I'm going to have to ask you, can you hold that thought for a minute?
Sure can.
Come back and wrap it up. We got into this a little bit late, but I do want to hear what you have to say about how this is going to play out. Fascinating story. Twilight in the Desert, the coming Saudi oil shock in the world economy, Matthew R. Simmons. It's Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Well, maybe if we make the right choices. Welcome back. We're talking with Matthew Simmons, the author of Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock in the World Economy. Looking through the book here, Matt, I see your comment that almost all of Iran's giant oil fields peaked long ago.
So
is that why Iran wants to have nuclear power?
Well, yeah.
I know they've got a lot of uranium there.
Well, they've actually got, they have 65 million people, and their oil now is struggling to stay above 3 million barrels a day, having peaked at 6 million barrels a day in the early 70s. They've never been able to sufficiently develop natural gas, and so they have to have some form of power.
Yeah.
I think one of the things people forget is that when you're actually, short of energy, there's nothing to take the place of it.
So is this a problem that's endemic around the Middle East?
You bet it is, yeah.
But what about the virgin oil fields of Iraq that had been relatively undeveloped because Iraq had been in turmoil for so many years?
That's actually an interesting concept, too. It's the western desert of Iraq that everyone keeps talking about. There's obviously so much oil there because it's never drilled. I just point out to friends that get so excited about this that I say, be realistic. They've explored for oil in Syria, Jordan, and throughout Saudi Arabia, outside the eastern province, for almost two-thirds of a century, and they've never found anything of any
size. And these are the areas that border the western side of Iraq.
Yeah, so why would you actually get... I mean, we haven't found any oil in Nevada and Arizona either, but there's not likely we're going to.
Right, so this bizarre logic, we haven't found any there, therefore there must be some.
Yeah, and it's amazing how many, quote, energy experts just assume that because we haven't drilled there's going to be oil there without looking at the geological success or lack thereof in the neighboring areas.
Well, when Dick Cheney said this, tell me if this is accurate or not.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Is that true?
Their reserves are listed as 110 billion barrels, and Saudi Arabia's are listed as 260 billion barrels. Again, like the other Middle East countries, that used to be 30 with the same number of fields. But even if it's 30, they're still an important oil producer. They're just nothing like what so many oil analysts thought they were going to be.
So what's going to happen?
Well, I think basically we should start assuming and then be pleasantly surprised if we're being overly cautious that the world has now reached sustainable peak oil production.
We've passed the Hubbard peak.
We've passed the Hubbard peak, and if it turns out that, no, that's wrong by 5 or 6 or 7 years, fabulous, because we have more time to prepare for some jolting changes that that we can actually make in 5 to 7 years. But if we ignore it for another 3 or 4 years, we ignore reforming energy data so we don't have any idea other than what people tell us, we're going to get the surprise of our lives.
And that is going to take the form of?
Well, if energy demand, if oil demand is poised to grow by necessity to 120 million barrels a day in 15 or 20 years, and by then we have oil supply of 60 million barrels a day.
You have world war.
You have scrambled neighbor after neighbor fighting.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about countries. I'm talking about neighborhoods fighting. So we just have to basically wake up to the fact that this was a finite resource. We gave it away for the last 100 years. I keep coming back. People keep talking about how high oil prices are, and I say, give me a break. $65 oil a barrel is 10 cents a cup.
Yeah, it's still cheaper than bottled water.
Than anything. There's nothing you can buy in America for 10 cents a cup other than oil.
Yeah, yeah, it's cheaper than a cup of coffee. So the imperative then is to immediately start conserving like crazy.
Conserving like crazy in some very profound
ways. And developing
ways.
Alternative energy sources.
Yeah, but when we get into alternative energy, we need to be very clear that wind and solar work, but they create electricity.
Right.
Oil is a transportation fuel.
Right, although there have been, just in the last month or so, some interesting developments in the development of hydrogen containing solids and things.
But, hydrogen isn't the primary form of energy. It's not even a secondary form of energy. So you have to have electricity to make hydrogen.
Right, it's a storage system.
Yeah, and our natural gas story is far more scary than oil.
Really?
Yeah.
Here domestically or worldwide?
Worldwide. Domestically particularly. We peaked 30 years ago.
What about the story that we're sitting on enough coal to keep us going for 300 years and we can convert that into oil?
That, again, is an interesting concept. But what's interesting also is that how sparse the data is. There's a lot of evidence that we probably pretty nearly depleted our large seams of high-quality black coal, and we're now turning to brown coal.
This is we're going from bituminous to anthracite. Is that?
Yeah. Well, I'm not a coal expert, so I'm not even sure. But brown coal basically is like low grade ore.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't quite have it. In the United States, we got totally reliant on the Powder River for our major coal supply, and then no one noticed we had one railroad, and the railroad collapsed this spring.
Yeah.
And so this summer we basically ran down our coal stocks because we couldn't get enough into the power plants and it was too hot. And then we thought, well, we'll get by with natural gas. And then came Katrina and Rita and destroyed the Gulf of Mexico's natural gas system. So if we have a cold winter, we're going to have to curtail gas this winter.
So we may be looking at the leading edge of the oil shocks within the next 3 or 4 months.
And I think the two hurricanes back to back, I've been saying for the last few days, this for the energy business was like in the Gulf of Mexico and the Gulf Coast was like having two back to back Pearl Harbors.
Hmm.
And like in Pearl Harbor, we lined up the whole fleet of our energy system offshore Louisiana and Texas and on the Gulf Coast of Louisiana and Texas, right in the epicenter of Hurricane Alley.
Yeah, and the solution is to wake up our politicians as quickly as possible.
To wake up Americans, not just politicians.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what's going to have to drive it. But, yeah, okay. All righty. Matthew Simmons, the book Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock and the World Economy. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
It's good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
My bills are all due, and the babies need shoes, but I'm busted.
Out of oil, Johnny?
Cotton is down to a quarter a pound, and I'm busted.
Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour.
I got a cow that went dry and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that get bigger each day. The county will haul my belongings away. I'm busted.
Are we looking at the leading edge of a worldwide Great Depression as a result of the oil shocks? Or could this be the beginning of the next revolution? This is one of the points, by the way, that Simmons makes toward the end of his book, Twilight in the Desert. I just, during the break, read the last chapter. And he makes essentially the same point that I make in The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which is that these kinds of transitions from one source of energy to another represent both danger and opportunity. You know, the old cliche about the Chinese symbol for danger is the same as the Chinese symbol for opportunity. They're two sides of the same coin. That there was a time when the world's primary energy source was wood. And then, in terms of, at least of light and transportation, we made the transition from wood to wind and whale oil. Wind, you know, the clipper ships. And transporting things across the ocean, it's all wind power. And whale oil, a major commodity. Everybody lighted and, you know, lit their homes with whale oil. And then the whales kind of went away. Whale oil transited out. And in many parts of Northern Europe, the United States, we went back to wood as a primary heat source. And then we went to coal. It's interesting. When I was living in Vermont, there was, during the late 19th century, the late 1800s, do you see the old photos, the old daguerreotypes? And the whole state was deforested. I mean, there wasn't a tree to be seen anywhere. And from the time of the Civil War up until, well, actually, from the late 1700s up through the 1860s, it was all sheep farmers. And then in the 1860s, from the 1860s to the 1880s, Vermont had lost a third of their population because of the gold rush out in California. People just said, that's it. You know, no more of this hard scrabble farming. I'm heading for California, and I'm going to get some gold. And they headed out. They lost a third of their population. But a good chunk of the reason why that happened was because all the trees had been cut. It was getting more and more expensive to get wood to heat a house in a place that had a very cold climate. And then in the 1880s, 1890s, the railroads from the Northeast ran up into Vermont. And all of a sudden, people started coming back, and the trees started growing again. Then you drive through Vermont now, and you see forest. I mean, it's just one end of the state to the other. It's all forest. There's, you know, it's not all bare like it used to be. Because there was coal to heat the houses with. The house that Louise and I were living in until we moved here to Oregon in March of this year, the house that we lived in was built in 1850. It originally was heated with coal. Actually, it was originally heated with wood. And then, you know, in the 1870s, 1880s, they replaced the wood furnace in the basement with a coal furnace when the railroad ran up into there. And then in the 1920s, they replaced the coal furnace with an oil furnace. And so, you know, these transitions happen. And each transition, each one of these transitions that we've had in the United States or around the world, look back over, I'm talking, you know, look at the arc of 5,000 years of history. Some say that the cause of the fall of the Roman Empire was because wood became scarce, because they had deforested Italy. It was the reason, well, actually, it was part of the rise of the Roman Empire in the early days, where it first extended beyond Rome. The reason why they built the 54 wooden ships and took off from Italy to invade southern Europe was because they had deforested to invade the rest of the Mediterranean was because they had deforested most of Italy. In fact, it caused a currency crisis. The price of silver doubled in a 10-year period, which nearly bankrupted the empire. And the reason that the price of silver went up was because the cost of the wood that was used to feed the blast furnaces that were used to smelt the silver went up because they had deforested. So they had to find another energy source. Well, the other energy source they got was going to other countries and getting wood. And getting slaves. So, you know, it's like humans are incredibly inventive. There is something to what Julian Simon said, that the greatest resource we have is the human mind. And there are ways through this. And we're at the point right now where we're faced with a choice. And we're faced with options. Are we going to choose to view this as an opportunity and use it to develop alternative sources of energy that not only will allow us to maintain a civilization and improve a civilization? Or are we going to, you know, stick our heads in the sand and continue just sucking on that straw, that oil straw, until there's nothing there anymore, and then go to war over it or see our civilizations collapse? And, of course, that latter path is the path that the Bush-Cheney administration has charted for us. And the former path of developing alternatives, this is what, you know, the Democratic Party for a long, long time has been talking about. But it even goes, you know, beyond that. I mean, you go back to Jimmy Carter. I mean, Jimmy Carter talking about, you know, we've got to do something about this. The energy crisis is real. It's not, you know, it's not just something that was made up. It's real. And he had actually a plan to do something about it. Jimmy Carter.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
That was July 15th, 1979. A year and a half later, Ronald Reagan comes into office, his first official act of office to remove the solar panels from the White House roof that Jimmy Carter had put up there and undo all the legislation that Carter had put in place that would transition the United States away from dependence upon foreign oil and increase our dependence on foreign oil. This was the official Reagan policy, to increase our dependence upon foreign oil. Why? Because it was profitable for the big oil companies who had put Reagan into power. And it continues to be the policy of the United States. Reagan, Bush, Carter, Bush, all four of them. And Jimmy Carter said, you know, let's take 20% of the economy, solar power. Sounds wild? He really said it.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
20%. That's more than all the oil that we buy from Saudi Arabia. We could say to Osama bin Laden, okay, take your country. We're not gonna have military bases in Saudi Arabia anymore. We don't need it. See you later. I mean, the amount of energy that falls on the earth every day from the sun is mind-boggling. That's where the oil came from in the first place. I mean, it was captured by plants 300 to 400 million years ago. So we have an extraordinary opportunity here. The problem is it's going to take leadership. It's going to take an awakened populace and leadership. And yes, there's all kinds of, you know, stuff in the news. And, you know, John Roberts, we've been talking about John Roberts and Tom DeLay and Roy Blunt and all this stuff. I'll tell you, if this winter you see home heating oil prices doubling and doubling again and doubling again, and you see us going back to the days of the 1930s before the Social Security was passed, where the leading cause, one of the leading causes of death for the elderly in the United States was poverty-related hypothermia in the winter and hunger year-round, then, you know, whether or not Tom DeLay goes to jail is going to become relatively insignificant. We'll look back and go, we get all upset about that? It's time for us to have a national energy policy. I mean, it's just very straightforward. We need a coherent national energy policy that is more than, oh, we need to drill in Anwar. Why do we need to drill in Anwar? Oh, we need the oil. National security, you see. Yeah, okay, let's bring it all down through one pipeline that any crazed person can blow up. And how much oil is it going to be? Well, it's going to be about enough to run the country for 6 months. And how long is it going to be before we start getting it? Well, it'll be about 10 years. That makes a lot of sense. That just makes a lot of sense. When right now there's such a demand for solar energy in the world that it's hard to buy solar panels, An incredible demand for these things. So, you know, it's time for, I don't mean to devolve into preaching here, but I think that one of the things that in your correspondence with your elected officials, you need to be saying, we all need to be saying collectively to our politicians, to those people who represent us. Again, this just makes me crazy. We elect leaders? No, we elect representatives. Those people who represent us, who are supposed to be doing our will, to say to them, you know, we would like a national energy policy. Jimmy Carter laid out a pretty good one in 1979. Over a 20-year period, it would have cut 20% of our reliance on fossil fuels and shifted it to solar. And it could have been done. Could have been done. And it could have been done without major dislocation of the economy. And we can still do it, but we have to begin right now. We have to begin right away. So let me suggest to you that you include that in your list of things to get political about, your things to get active about. It is 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, the Tom Hartman Radio Program here, the True People's Radio.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You gave them the old, stay the course, I'm your man. Why, he'll flip-flop ya.
Well, look out for that John Kerry.
No strength to lead, yes, this you feared. While soldiers' jobs and surplus disappeared. Gave them the old... Devil, yeah, devil speak. Yes, with folks so windled hum. No one could hear the truth above the roar. And though your debating was a stinker, they bought it all, hook, line, and sinker. You razzle-dazzled them, and they gave you four more.
Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
You cannot lead if you send mixed messages.
And welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. And folks, whenever we play that bumper, there's always, you know, I always get a couple of emails going, who is that? It's Bill Jacobs. BillJacobs.us is his website. So just spell just like it sounds, J-A-C-O-B-S. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Margaret in Everett, Washington, on the line. Hey, Margaret, what's up?
Yes, Tom. Well, I'm heavy into campaign for this Democratic Party and AM 1090 against, we have here in Washington something that is happening all over the United States. It's our Patty Murray, Senator, has on numerous occasions this year stood right up there and kissed the right wing in every way and voted for him.
Yeah, although I've got to say, Maria Cantwell certainly did an admirable job of standing up to John Roberts. God bless her. I just tip my hat to her. She did so well. She was on my my Portland, Oregon radio program here earlier in the week, and we talked about John Roberts, and she hadn't made up her mind. And then the next day or the day after that, she came out and said she was against him. And I'm not saying I had anything to do with that, but she seemed like a very thoughtful person who has pretty good politics. So,
well, anyway. She stands up for Washington.
Yeah.
And Patty Murray pretends to, but she has proven during the past year that she does not.
Yeah.
Because she has held hands in every way. I want to say this on the radio so that everybody can hear it.
Okay.
And some people don't know it. But she has held hands and linked up and married up with that whole bunch in Washington, that whole bunch of crooks and thieves and everything else you could say. And then she went and voted for John Roberts.
I know.
Margaret, we are going to campaign against her.
No, Margaret, let me take this to a larger frame. It's something that all of our listeners all across the United States can relate to, because the 22 senators voted against John Roberts, only 22. And so this is a problem that a lot of states have. And not just on the Roberts nomination, on the bankruptcy bill, we saw the same thing on, you know, on the Medicare. But, you know, it just goes on and on and on. There's you know, all these folks who have been selling out and have not been held accountable. But here's the problem. The first bill, the first vote that Patty Murray will make at the beginning of every legislative session is the most important vote that she makes during the entire year, and that's the vote for leadership. Mm-hmm. And what the, you know, the bottom line here is that it's until we have a Democratic majority in the Senate or in the House of Representatives, it's more important to have even a bad Democrat than to have a Republican. And if you start campaigning against Patty Murray and wound her politically in such a way that, you know, you're not going to have a Democrat who's going to successfully challenge her. So if you wound her in such a way that you end up with a Republican representing the state of Washington, you've jumped out of the frying pan right into the fire, pardon the old cliche. Far better, I think, far more important is to make these folks, these Democrats that are sort of half Democrats, make them aware of the fact that we are keeping track of them, we are monitoring them, we are paying attention, we do care, we are politically active, we are going to hold their feet to the fire, and over time try to get them to wake up and change their votes. And I've seen this happen actually with a number of politicians over the years where suddenly they go, hey, wait a minute, people are paying attention. Or very often they get so lost in the whole inside the beltway thing, they forget about, you know, why they're in politics in the first place and what serving the people really means. So, if I may strongly suggest that instead of trying to defeat Patty Murray, you try to change her, because you already have a Democratic senator in your state. That's a big deal.
Well, I guess, you know, what we're trying to say is she pretends to be, but then she can't get away from holding hands with both sides, which a lot of them do that, of course.
Well, and that's where you want to hold her accountable. But in my, you know, and this is not a sellout position, by the way. I'm not saying be wishy-washy. I'm not saying put up with this stuff. I'm saying, you know, be loud, be outspoken. You know, she has offices in all probability in the town that you live in or nearby.
Oh, yeah.
Visit them. You know, say we want you to start holding town meetings. We want you to be accountable. Like Bernie Sanders says, you know, actually pull together, get together 150 people or so and, you know, organize a meeting and then say, you know, Senator Murray, we're going to have a meeting and we would like you to be here because we're going to talk about you and, you know, show up and, you know, like that and start holding these people accountable. And that will bring them around. I can't say I guarantee it, but I have seen it happen time after time. And I really think that politicians, by and large, are not leaders. They are followers. And by and large, they follow the public will. And as long as Patty Murray or any member of Congress, a House or Senate, thinks that the best way for them to maintain their position of power and the best way for them to continue on in office, which is generally their first priority, is to suck up to the special interests and the insiders in Washington, you know, they'll keep on doing it. And when they figure out that their best way to stay in power is to engage the people and do the things that the people want, and we're pretty unambiguous about it. The majority of Americans actually want a national health care system. The majority of Americans want strong Social Security. The majority of Americans want a clean environment. The majority of Americans, I mean, it's not rocket science, but we have to start standing up and speaking out and saying it loudly and over and over and over again. And like I said, Margaret, I really appreciate your passion. And
Thank you. And
please work to reform Patty Murray before you try and reject her, okay?
Well, we're just a lot of people here are up in arms about that.
I understand.
And they are ready to throw her in the furnace.
Yeah, well, you know, have that conversation with her staff. You know, give them a call in the local office or the national office and let them know. Margaret, thanks so much for the call. Great to hear from you. It's the end of the day. So we'll see you again tomorrow. Thanks for being with us so much today. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. See you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.